In this episode of the Stamina Lab podcast, I spoke with Ed Lattimore. Ed's a former professional heavyweight boxer, competitive chess player, and a best-selling author, including the book Sober Letters to My Drunken Self. In this episode, we talk about how your environment, especially the people around you, impact your success and ability to change. Just showing up at the gym, getting in that environment, Ed said, set up a cascade of interactions that propelled him to want to be better, including his boxing coach and how he modeled his life, which helped lead Ed to getting sober. We also talk about how getting sober impacted his boxing career and his writing. I know you'll get a lot out of this conversation, so let's get started.
Welcome to the newest episode of Stamina Lab, hosted by me, Glenn Lubert. If you're ready to upgrade your performance, achieve mental clarity, and improve your well-being, well, then you're in the right place. You'll hear the stories of professionals who have taken on big challenges while managing their energy and longevity through the ups and downs of pursuing their goals. Enjoy this episode, then head to the show notes to learn more so you can take the next steps to build the habits and systems you need to achieve your dreams.
Okay, Ed, thanks for joining me on the show.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. I'm always happy whenever somebody just wants to hear me ramble, you know?
All right, well, you're full of insights, and I really wanted to talk about one of the key parts of behavioral design and making change in your life is your environment. That's the spaces you're in, the people that you interact with, and the things that you choose to do and utilize for your success or lack of success. And, you know, there's no way to start this conversation without talking about the environment where you grew up. And I'm from Pittsburgh area. And so I know that the Hill District where you grew up, that's the place where we were told not to go. My sister went to University of Pittsburgh, and that they told their students, don't stop.
Because that area, University of Pittsburgh is borders that, like, University of Pittsburgh sits into a hill-ish. And then above that hill in level one, they recently just bought it maybe 10 years ago or so. So it's not nearly as dangerous, but like Trees Hall up there where the pool and everything is, that was like directly in the project, and they had this giant fence, and like you were not supposed to go around out at night from there. It was a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So that was what the impression that I had from that area. So obviously, I wanted to hear what it was like when you were there. My sister was in this school in the mid '90s. So I know it started changing around then, but that's when you were there, correct?
I was born when like my earliest memories are there. I lived there till I was 9 years old when they moved us to another project across town. So it's not like I moved to another better neighborhood. I moved to another housing project. What I remember, and the commonalities are all the same, whether it's the Hill District or Northview Heights where I ended up moving. And in those commonalities, it's a lot of. So there's like the age old, chicken versus egg, chicken or egg debate. Does poverty cause crime or does crime cause poverty? And it's in the United States, I think it's very hard to tell which direction that runs at the same level. And so I say all this to say that it's a lot of poor people and a lot of crime. And when you're poor, you're forced to do things to make ends meet. But when you do things that make ends meet, it makes it more likely you remain poor because it shuts you further out the legal employment market. So I witnessed a lot of drug dealing and violence and grew up around all of this stuff. You never feel safe at home. You never feel safe in the street and then at home because of the type of people. My mom wasn't like, she did her best. I would like to believe that at least. But it's still, she wasn't, she had habits and perspectives based on everyone around her and the people who raised her to get her there. So, you know, those attitudes get transmitted down to us. And I was fortunate that I had a set of experiences that put me in a different place. Oh, it's a small deviation, but it makes a big deal compared to how I am now compared to most of the people in my family. So it's everything it's cracked up to be is the best way to put it.
And so that's definitely telling because with your mom, obviously the people around you have a high influence on your life and how you go about what's important, what you value. And so how did you take away the good parts of that, but were able to then have that people not impact you in a negative way?
Well, yeah, I didn't really. I mean, so your environment is, you know, I don't remember where I read the quote or the idea. I can't even remember the exact quote, but the general idea really stuck with me. That the only thing that you have control over when it comes to your children and what they grow up and who they turn into is like the genes that you give them, like your health and everything like that, IQ, physical abilities, et cetera, and the zip code they're in. You control that too. Other than that, everything else kind of is beyond their control. And what happened to me is they had in the Pittsburgh public school system this gifted program where they identify students they think have potential to perform better or higher, you know, based on, and then they do an IQ test and they go, oh, okay, you're that guy or you're not that guy. And I was one of those kids. And so one day a week, I go to a different school with all the other type of kids like me in a different location and then a different part of town. And I see something different. And, you know, I don't know exactly why it's different, but I know it's different. And I look forward to being there. And that continues until I get to middle school or until I get to high school. And in high school, there's no gifted program for a high school up. But instead, there's something called, they call it CAS class, Center for Advanced Studies. And so I'm in classes with people who went that route. And I chose to go to a high school that didn't feed in, that my neighborhood didn't feed into. It's a magnet program. I had to apply and I got into that school. So that puts me in a very different socioeconomic environment than the one I grew up in. And now I'm spending most of my time there. All my friends are from there. I'm spending my time there. And then at school, you know, 8 hours a day. That makes a big difference. That's a huge difference. And so it's not like that's the answer, really. It's not that I didn't. It's not that I was able to separate the good from the bad. It's just that at an early enough point in my life, I got different influences and I got to meet different people. And this makes the timing is a big deal because I got cousins and family members who I exposed to my life and my world, but they're too old, too ingrained. It's like that quote in The Matrix where Morpheus is explaining to Neo, he says, you know, we never free a mind beyond a certain age because the mind has difficulty letting go. And it's very true. Once you get, you got to remember, you know, I'm 38 now. So I've been an adult longer than I've been a child now ever since I turned 36. So the first half of your life, all you've known, everything you've known, that's a lot. Like it makes a big impression. And if you don't get anything different from that, and most people don't, then you're going to continue and carry. And then now, if you're motivated and you maybe get lucky or something like that, you know, maybe, but it's rare. I think it is relatively rare. Now, I don't know how that changes in the internet age where now, because we didn't have this. This is what kids have today. Now you get online and you're able to see things and learn directly from people and communicate and interact with people non-locally. didn't have that when I was a kid. So I can't speak to the effect that would have today on a child growing up who was born in like 2010. But I know born in 1985, man, it's limiting, or was limiting.
Yeah, that's just goes to show how much helping young people makes a difference, and you know, letting that helping hand. That environment that you went to, you went back to the housing projects every day. You know, obviously it's where you're living. So you know how did when people get into a new different environment, obviously it's so much easier for change. But you kept going back to the other environment. So I'm curious how you were able to not let that other environment continue to seep and influence you.
I wasn't happy. So that's really easy. You know, one of the problems my sister had, she had friends. She liked where she was at. She didn't even want to go to a different high school. You know, my mom didn't push us either way. I decided. I said, they're going to enroll me here, and we're going to figure this out. But my sister, she didn't have any desire. She liked her friends and enjoyed being there. I didn't want to be there. So that's already a plus. And you don't realize how these things are going to play out later in your life. I have no idea. But it's a plus. And then I was fortunate. A kid wrote a book about it. I think everyone should read, called The Schindler Experiment. The high school I went to was one of those. So sort of history of it. It was a school that that was integrated long before Brown versus the Board of Education, and on top of that, you know, it had its downtime in the 70s, but then in the 80s, they got a superintendent. They got a superintendent who really focused on attaining and retaining top talented teachers. And so by the beginning of the 90s, parents who were capable of sending their children to the private schools in the area, and you're from Pittsburgh, so they were capable of sending their kids to Oakland Catholic, Central Catholic, Shadyside Academy, Ellis, right? They're lining up, like literally lines around the block to enroll their kids to go to Schindler, because Schindler was the international baccalaureate school. It was the school for the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater, where they sent the ballerinas they recruited. We had a top-tier sports program. And that's key, you know. It's just the reality of it. It's not racist or anything. We had state championship basketball team, because Schindler, despite its all of these things that it brought in to attract top academic talent, it was the feeder school for the Hill District. So if you were from the, so a lot of kids from the Hill, well, a lot of good athletes were going there. And so we had a great program, and it was a great experiment. It was a masking of worlds that almost never occurs. You like kids who literally are in the project work, and kids who lived in private roads and mansions in Shadyside, going to school together, learning from one another. Four languages taught there. It was an incredible place. And being in that place was the start. I liked that place. I met great friends there. So those people, I had to go home every night, but one of my good friends, you know, his family would drive me home every night at like 8 o'clock. I have dinner over there. I spent a lot of time. As a result, I went to a bar mitzvah for a sister. I learned a lot about the Jewish faith in general, because I was there all the time. And they didn't, you know, to the point, like some of my best friends, the parents and the children, when we had our baby shower, they came for all that. And they continue to be an influence in my life, because these people acted, they understood, you know, they never said anything. I never felt like I was some type of experiment or token child out of from the other side of the tracks. They just didn't reject me. And that embrace of that, plus me just seeing what a stable family unit looked like. Because of all my friends, only one of them, his mom just remarried. But they all looked like we're in two-parent households. I'd never seen that until I got to high school. I thought everybody's dad just didn't live with them, other than like TV, where I was like, oh, that's like fiction, though. So that's one of the things that changed me, man, is seeing that.
Do you strive to boost your energy, focus, creativity, and flow while keeping burnout at bay? Then Stamina Lab Sleep and Recovery Coaching Program is tailored just for you. At Stamina Lab, we believe sleep isn't just a nice to have. It's a sophisticated performance tool and the foundation for unparalleled daily energy and creativity. Through the fusion of behavior design, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and nervous system management, we provide you with personalized, data-driven insights to construct lasting sleep habits and sleep confidence. Abandon the trial and error of self-guided apps and caffeine fixes. It's time to unlock a sharper mind, stronger body, and steadier emotional balance through expert one-on-one human coaching. Take the first step towards mastering the science and art of sleep and recovery. Download your free Sleep Interruptions Wake and Recovery Guide by visiting sleep.staminalab.io. Reshape your nights to transform your days. Embrace yourself for a remarkable journey to enhance cognitive function, resilience, and stamina at sleep.staminalab.io. So how did that transition into your boxing career? Like how was your support system, your family, your friends, your coach, how did they play in that success?
So when you leave that environment, you lose the support. I didn't realize how dependent on that support I had really been until I went to college the first time when I was 19, and I dropped out three semesters. More like failed out, but I dropped out before they could kick me out. And I wasn't doing anything at all in my life. And then one day, I had been rallying against college. I had been doing that, talking about how stupid college was instead of the other. And the girl I was dating, her mom was a professor at the University of Pittsburgh. So one day she says, like, let's pretend that you're right and college is like nothing. And what have you done with your life for the past 4 years other than show up at my house and eat my food? And then she threw me out. But she was right. I hadn't done anything, and I wanted to get some sweat equity. So I decided I was going to start boxing. Because it was just the path that was open to me. What I didn't want to be was just a guy who had never, a typical 20-something who has no hobbies other than drinking and going to work or going to school with that or whatever it is. And that's what led to that. I think I had a decent support system, but by support system, I mean like some of my friends cared, some of them didn't, but it wasn't important, but it didn't matter to me that they cared or not. It was one of those decisions that I made for me, because if I didn't do it for me, like if I waited for other people to co-sign or support, there were a lot of things I wouldn't have done that have been a tremendous help for me and really changed my life. But I would not, when I think about support system, I mean, they weren't like against it. I mean, like some of my friends were like, what are you doing this for? You're like 22. Why are you starting to fight? They couldn't understand it, because most people, and this is a good thing, can't understand someone who willingly goes to fight. But outside of that, it was something I had to do for me.
Yeah, well, did you have a coach? You know, has anybody helped?
I had a few coaches. Yeah, and I had a few coaches when I started as an amateur, and then my professional career, I had the same coach the whole time. And what the coaches do, I'm actually, it's funny, I'm writing about this right now. What the coaches do, there's something called the Pygmalion effect, which is, when you expect people to behave a certain way, they're more likely to behave that way, for better or worse. And so what happens in boxing for me, or what happened in boxing for me, is I had probably for the first time, at least definitely for the first time in my adult life, people who expected me to do certain things and carry myself a certain way. And I was, you know, already more or less committed, blood committed to boxing. I was like, I'm going to do this and I'm either going to get hurt or someone's going to be like, you suck and stop doing this. And it's going to be obvious. Like, I've been knocked out like 7 times in a row. So I was like, I was, you know, there to do this thing for a long time. But what really helps is, you know, when people expect you to be in the gym every day, when people expect you to fight hard, you know, like there's, for example, it happens, but it's a faux pas for you to ever, you know, pull out of a fight. Even though there's no penalty for it as an amateur, it's just gonna be hard. It'll be harder to get on shows, but like, and some guys do that. But the expectation that I couldn't do that if I wanted to do this, that it helps. That makes you dedicated and focused. You know, you don't want to lose. You're putting a lot of energy into your training, and you don't know what's going to come of it, but you know what you're getting from it now. And so that made a big difference. Now, when I turned professional, that coach, Tommy Ankello, he not only did he make me a better fighter, he made me a better human too, in a lot of ways. So once again, it's the power of expectation, man. Tom is like a health nut. Like I'm pretty serious about my fitness and health, but compared to Tom, I'm basically eating a standard American diet, not doing shit, man. Because this is a guy. I mean, to put it in perspective, we've had full blown arguments over me drinking juice. Now I don't drink juice that often, but I needed something to drink that I didn't want water, man. And we fought about that. One time I went to his father. Was having a birthday party. His father helps him to gym. He's like 89, man, like strong guy. And so his birthday cake at his house where the birthday party is being had. And he starts ripping into me when I have a piece of cake. And I'm like, brother, you invited me to the house with the cake. And he's like, I didn't eat the cake. Why are you eating the cake? Like, and I'm like, okay. But that's like the kind of person he was. Or is, not was. He's very much alive. When you have someone treat you that way and expect more of you, you get kind of. I mean, after all, I'm spending like every day, many hours of my life with this man for 4 or 5 years. That eventually has an effect. It's one of the reasons that helped me get sober.
Yeah. So really, the motivation initially was your motivation to do something, but then really this expectation of the people around you of a higher level of performance kept you going and took you to that next level.
Absolutely. You know, look, motivation is really good as a spark plug. And discipline is what you need to continue to grind. But like, there are moments where you're too far in to quit, but not so far that you feel like the end is in sight or there's a reward coming. And having people believe in you is the wrong model. Having people model a certain way to live, that really works wonders. Because you are your environment. And so when you spend your time around certain people or certain things, you become that. And if you want to become that, it's a lot easier than if you don't want to. Like, if I was committed to drinking and eating like a slob, who knows what changes. But because I was committed to being the best fighter I could become and getting sober, it really made a difference.
Yeah, I do want to chat about that. But I want to chat before you get that. I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, when you were fighting. And the mental preparation that went into that, like how did you mentally prepare for these fights?
Mental preparation is, I mean, I don't want to say a joke, but like it's overrated. What I did is I trained like a madman. I trained, and my thought process for training was, I'm going to eliminate the role of chance to the, you know, as much as I possibly can. I'm going to eliminate the role of the unknown as much as I possibly can. And remember what this means, right? I don't know. Like maybe there's film out there. Maybe there isn't. Let's just assume there's film out there for the sake of argument. Film out there on the opponent. I don't know how much he's improved since then. I don't know what he's capable of. I don't know if that was a good day or a bad day that I watched. So all I have to do is make sure I'm maximally prepared, ultimately prepared, so that when we face off, that if he wins, it's not going to be because I lost, if that makes sense. If he wins, it's going to be because he performed better than me, period. And I was already performing well. That's the only, you know, to me, that's what preparation is. Because look, yeah, man, is it scary to box? I mean, fuck, man, it's scary to drive. No one ever thinks about that. Like the rate of dying and driving is a lot higher than boxing. But people do that every day. Is that scary? Absolutely, it is. But you feel safe. I think. And you feel safe and you feel prepared. You learn how to drive. You use your turn signal. You got your seatbelt on. You got your airbags. You're in this big steel container. So you don't feel exposed, but you are much more – you're in much bigger danger than I ever am in the ring. And I think keeping that in mind – and then maybe not keeping that in mind. Maybe just ignoring that fact makes a difference. There's something definitely not right with anyone who fights continuously. I used to think that was just something people said to sound tough. And the older I get and the more I study fighters and study myself, the more, not only do I think that's true, I think the better you are off in life, the harder it's going to be for you to excel at this sport in any capacity, because Marvin Hagler used to say, you know, it's hard to get up and run when you sleep in his silk pajamas. This is very, like, I can't think of anything other than winning, and that only lasts when you win. There is nothing enjoyable about boxing. It's a way out and a focusing point for a lot of us. Now, that doesn't mean it's not useful. That just means, in terms of useful things, there are probably less painful ways to develop the traits that you develop in a fight. But maybe there isn't. But I never had to worry about that. I was never scared. You know, I'd been through enough in my life. I'd been hurt. So I'm not scared. I mean, there we go. There's a natural predisposition from a rough upbringing to have a greater capacity to suffer. And to have less fear about it. It's like, what's a good example? It's like, you already done something hard. You don't look at the next hard thing as anything to freak out about. If you've already been hurt before, if you've already been starving, if you've already been in street fights, you mean I'll be in a ring and I don't have to worry about somebody jumping me? Oh, this is a piece of cake. All right, I don't have to worry about somebody whipping out a brick. The cops aren't going to show up. Oh, this is nothing, right? And that's kind of the deal. It's, you know, fighting. But if you can force yourself in that environment, I think there are a lot of benefits. I don't think there's anything on this planet that, except maybe special forces training. I've never done special forces training, but from what I understand of it, it's in the same realm where you really risk your life to learn the skills. And when you make the mistakes, there's a very powerful negative feedback mechanism, and you learn through hardship, you learn through difficulty, and real hardship and difficulty and pain. Not like, you know, there are a lot of mindset people and stuff, like founders on the internet and all that, talking about productivity and discipline and all that. I'm like, nah, bro. You don't know what it's really like to have to get out the mud. I think that's one of the appeals of David Goggins, I think. Because when you read Goggins' story, he gets it, man. That's a dude that he's been in that and lived that kind of pain. And so people, so when I listened, I really like listening to him. I think there's a lot of unresolved pain in his story. That's a different story. But when I hear it, it sounds authentic. Like, it's real to me. It's real to me because I recognize it.
And that's really what drove. That's what you say. That's what really drove you to boxing. Was that resilience that you?
I mean, I didn't know how I was going to turn out. Absolutely for boxing, but that's what it certainly helped me survive.
Yeah, it makes sense. Now you you mentioned a little bit about your drinking and you quit drinking partly because of the model that your coach. The lifestyle your model your coach modeled for you, but most of your boxing career you were drinking. How did that impact your career?
My amateur career and my first three professional fights, I was drinking. And you know, like, you can get under control when there's something big on the line. Absolutely. But it affects your training. It affects the things you do. It affects your recovery. It affects your performance. Your ability to get better in between fights. Like sure, sober the week before the fight each time. But what about that time in between where you got to go to the gym and train? Are you getting better? Not nearly as good as you could be getting if you were not, you know, drinking or messing around. So, could I have had a better amateur career without alcohol? Probably, but I don't know for sure. What I do know is that alcohol prevents you; it keeps you from dealing with things, right? And I probably wasn't learning from the losses or the emotional. Or learning how to deal with the emotions, both the highs and the lows, because I was celebrating with alcohol. But fortunately, I never made any serious mistakes. And that's luck. You know, I could have been pulled over several times under the influence. Luck, just luck that I don't have a criminal record and I can freely enter Canada, for example. It's luck. You know, not everyone's so lucky. I worked the math out on this once. It's like, your odds, if you are under the influence, your odds of being pulled over worked out to approximately 1 in 2,700. So you know what that says? Like, if you look at that in the pure, that like if you interpret those numbers in the pure sense of the word, that if you get a DUI, you're unlucky. Even if you were drinking, driving under the influence, right, you're unlucky. Now, the only way to reduce that to zero is to not drink. But, like, my point is that of all the, like, your odds, about 1 in 2,700, and that's insane to me. But I'm fortunate. But I always say you can't outrun the law of larger numbers. If I keep doing it, eventually I'm a get caught. And I'm happy I stopped before. Because so much of my life, like, I look around, you know, I'm not like a rich dude or anything like that, very comfortable. And I know a lot of that is because I was able to go and do so many things that at the very least would have been difficult to the point where they may have dissuaded me if I was battling a criminal record trying to do it.
Now, did you notice your performance in the ring improved afterwards?
Oh, man, I could sleep. I was reacting better. I was healing faster. Absolutely. But here's the, you know, I'm so thankful the research is coming out, because finally, what science is recognizing, what every fucking alcoholic in the world knows intimately, there's no amount of alcohol that's good for you. They came up with that resveratrol nonsense. You know, it's resveratrol, right? Not the alcohol that makes a difference. The alcohol nullifies the effect of resveratrol. There's no amount that's good for you, right? Now, there's certainly an amount that is not going to turn you into a fool, but think about that. You got to manage a relationship with something, with a poison, you know? It's in many ways, if you don't know what's lurking, it's playing a modified version of Russian roulette. You know, you might have that gene where it's like, let's go, brother, let's saddle up and ride. Or you might be the dude who's normal. And when you look at the numbers on this, yeah, it's kind of like Russian roulette. There are a few surveys in between. It's like it ranges between 12% and 25% of Americans are regular binge drinkers. As in more than four drinks at one time, and regular, I would say, more than once a week. So if you look at it that way, it's about, you know, playing with a six shooter, 12.5 chance, or an eight shooter, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it really helped. One of the biggest things is it helped your sleep. Obviously, we at Stamina Lab, we do a lot of work with helping people improve their sleep. And, you know, alcohol is one of the key drivers that prevent people from getting, you get unconscious, but you don't actually get your rest.
Yeah. It's crazy, right? Because you don't slip into, what is it, deep when you're under alcohol? REM sleep.
Yeah.
So your eyes are closed. But you're not getting any of the benefits. It's a rough state, man.
But you noticed that you're physically performing better afterwards.
Not only did I notice that, but I'll tell you what, there is absolutely no way I could have got my physics degree if I was drinking. Like, it's just, you know, but because it's not just the mental performance. That's when I get to the game. Right. But it's getting to the game, too, man, and being prepared. Like the hours it takes to study, the hours it takes to train. When you drink, that's the time you probably going to spend trying to go to the bar or something ridiculous. And so it eliminated a lot of distractions that just come built into the lifestyle drinking that you don't even think about. It's a lot like what happens when you get a girl, right? Well, you don't realize how much energy you spent in courtship ritual until you are no longer participating in the courtship ritual, and you suddenly have Friday nights free, Thursday nights free, Saturday nights free, your phone is empty, so you're not checking notifications from whatever dating app, you got more money. You're like, whoa, being single is not cheap, right? Because you're still trying to fulfill that urge. And it's like that with drinking. You don't realize how much drinking costs you until you get it back. And it's not even the time. I mean, beer is cheap, man. Like, very cheap. The real cost is the time. The time and the risk.
Yeah, and I think the mental fortitude that you get, similar to the mental fortitude that you got when you're growing up, that you get you don't really have like a mental pregame or pre-match, but you know, you kind of have that by just the small little resilience that you build every time you make the tough decision.
Absolutely. Make more tough decisions, and you get better at making tough decisions. And look, when it comes to making tough decisions, it's not so much that your equipment for making the decision improves, like your ability to analyze and sift through data, you know, to separate signal from noise, all that stuff. One of the things that happens is you develop the courage to make the decision and see through it, and that gets stronger and stronger and stronger. I recognized that I had an issue with alcohol probably 3 years prior, two or three years before I finally stopped. And one of the things that was hard for me was stopping. I tried many, many times. It's, you know, one of my friends wanted this, that, the other, or I was afraid to feel like I was going to stand out and not fit in. It wasn't until that I developed this resolve that just kept building up over time, and finally, and then on top of that, you know, you reach your personal rock bottom. Everyone's rock bottom is different. I reached mine and I go, I got to do this for me. Otherwise, who knows? In fact, I remember clearly, again, another Matrix reference. There's that scene in The Matrix where they pick Neo up and they take him to go see Morpheus for the first time. And there's the bug in his stomach, and they take the bug out of his stomach and he tosses it out, and he's about to run and escape. And Trinity stops him, and she's like, nah, man, you don't want to do that. And Neo's like, why? And it's great direction. It pans down the alleyway. It's dark and it's raining. And it's like, because you've been down that road before, Neo. You know where it goes. You know how it ends. And you don't want to be there, right? That's one of those things that I ended up doing and saying to myself when it was time to – when I finally was able to stick to it. And that took resolve to go, this is for me. It's like the boxing that was, it's the same kind of decision, right? This is for me to start boxing. Same with sobriety. This is for me. I don't care how you guys respond. And before I care, in fact, when I left my first AA meeting, I texted my five best friends and I said, hey, I'm just letting you guys know I got to stop drinking. I got a problem. And, you know, if you guys don't want to kick it with me anymore, I get it. I was like, I was afraid of that. These are my good friends. None of them responded that way, and they're all great friends today. But I was worried about that. It was real fear. But I reached the point where I said, I got to do this for me. Doesn't matter. I was prepared for it, but it didn't matter.
Is there any parallels that you draw between the discipline you required in your boxing and the discipline you require to maintain your sobriety?
Nah, not really. I mean, like, actually, you want to know in the weirdest way, the weirdest parallel? If you just get yourself in position, a lot of stuff just works out. So when I'm talking about position in boxing right now, what I'm saying is if all I had to do was make sure I got to the gym. The hard part is deciding to go to the gym. That's where the resistance is going to be. Because once I get to the gym, I got no choice but to work out. I've driven there, got my gear, the bags there, coach there. All I got to do is walk in. That was my only win. If I do that, the rest of the workout and training is won. No matter how I feel, walk into the gym. With sobriety, I didn't realize this until it happened. I did not go out after dark for over a year. My sobriety date is December 23rd, 2013. The next time I was out after dark was because I went out to watch the John Bones Jones versus Daniel Cormier fight. And we watched it at Dave and Buster's. But that was like, it was like January something, 2015. And by that time, I had been so focused and had made so much progress and had become such a different person. I had real achievements that I really cared about. I was like, okay, I got a semester of school down and a year in the Army and like people respect me. And so it was easy. But all I had to do was not go in a bar, not go out, not socialize. Like, now I can go out and then I'm like, all right, whatever, I'm out of here. I'm not tempted whatsoever to drink. And I don't know if I would have been. But because I just took care of the environment, that's the easy part. You take care of the environment, the rest of it takes care of itself.
Yeah, so much makes everything so much easier to achieve all your goals if you set your environment up right, and that includes the people around you. So you said that you text your five best friends, and did you just start doing different things with them?
Yeah, you know, one of the cool things about removing alcohol, man, is you're forced to connect with folks because alcohol is this weird third. It's like a two and a half wheel. It's not a third wheel. It's like two and a half. It's a reason to come together and act like you like people so you don't feel lonely. I think a lot of people are seriously one missed happy hour away from feeling like legitimately lonely. And we're social creatures. We need to be around one another. And alcohol provides a very easy way to tolerate people you don't necessarily want to be around. I lost a lot of friends, like a lot of people I interact with. But they were all people I had met during my drinking hours. Those five friends that I texted, those are guys that I know that I met when I made that transition in my life to that other high school. These are guys that I've known now longer than I haven't, you know? So And that, those friends, you know, well, we started going to coffee, right? Getting together for chess, chat, dinner, stuff like that. And now it's even easier because, like, what, one, two, three of five of them are married to with kids and all that. So it's now it's just a different phase of our life. It's easy, but I made it to that phase because I stopped drinking. I know they may or may not have just made it there. I know I got there because of my change, and it was just easier for me. I couldn't do it. They because they came from stable, you know, and no one likes to talk about that. Well, okay, they actually try to talk about this. I won't say that. But your predisposition to alcohol is directly correlated with how many adverse childhood experiences you've had. And this is something that blew my mind. There's a real like test exam that was exhibited or questionnaire exhibited to over like 50,000 people about their adverse childhood experiences. You can find a version of it on the internet. And every child has had at least one, usually, right? Almost all children have had at least one. But after that, it climbs quickly. Your risk for things like alcoholism, addiction, getting in prison. The average prisoner has four adverse childhood experiences. I had seven, right? So like seven of the 10. And then they fall into five categories. Abuse, whether that's physical, mental, and sexual, enmeshment, where it's hard to where the boundaries of what is where the boundaries are basically ignored, codependency, that kind of thing, neglect, witnessing traumatic events or witnessing violent events, kind of deal, right? And then like abandonment and neglect are similar, but not the same. Neglect is like we in the house, but we don't really care about you. Abandonment is you have been taken by another family kind of deal, right? Like, and they're going to deal with you. So that kind of thing makes a big difference when you grow up. It's no coincidence, I think. Are no happy accident that of all of my friends, I'm the one with the issue and I'm the one that grew up in the hellhole. They had really stable families and a community and a network. To put it in perspective, I mean, my family, other than my sister, my family doesn't have any contact with my kid. God, I don't have any contact with my family. So why would they have any contact with my kid? My mom died over a year ago. That was the last kind of conduit. And me and her didn't have, like, a great relationship. So and my dad died way back when I was 18. So you get these things together. And it's not like he was around. I cried because someone died. But, like, I could probably tally the hours and keep it under three digits. In fact, definitely keep it under three digits that we spent collectively together in his 18 years. And that includes a time that I can't remember because I was too young. He took me when my sister, my mom was giving birth to my sister. One of my earliest memories is when he brought me home and I met my sister for the first time.
Now, obviously, definitely when you get sober, you're going to improve your focus in overall, in general. Your mental clarity comes into play. What would you say was, you know, something when how did it improve your focus for your boxing career? And then how did it improve your focus outside the ring?
Well, I'm not doing anything to drink. So all that stuff was out the way. My life became boxing, school, and my girlfriend. That's pretty much who's now my wife now. But like, see how that works out? because I wasn't thinking, let me go out and drink, party, or do whatever, right? Well, I could focus on what was important to me, what mattered. Because when you're dealing with any type of addiction, that's what's important to you. Whether you know it or not, whether you want to admit it or not, that by definition, that is the most important thing to you. even if you don't want it to be. And that certainly was the case for me.
So you wrote several books now. Sober Letters to My Drunken Self is one of those books. And so how did your experiences getting sober and obviously being a boxer influence your writing?
Yeah, I have a deeper well to draw upon. I think that when you're from a rough background, when you're more relatable, you can speak to more ranges of the human condition. People read what you write, and because what you write is based on your experiences and is unique as we like to think we are, we're not. There's lots of other people that have experienced what I've experienced, but they can. People know when you're just talking out your ass and when you really have lived it, no matter how you put it, no matter how you say it, or no matter how it's explained. It's really interesting. I think one of the things that has really helped me build an audience is that my writing draws from there's a human element to it. I don't, you know, anybody can focus on, I think, the mental aspect of things. Let's work on our mindset. Let's work on our discipline. Let's, you know, productivity is hacks. But there's another animal entirely, the emotional side of things. Not only do you have to have experienced it, but you need to be able to dissect it and then redistribute it in a way to where it's useful. You're not just, you know, being cathartic or complaining. And that's, if you look at a lot of my writing, it's been influenced heavily by these experiences.
And so when you're getting into your writing, when you're actually doing that, your writing process, do you have any routines or like, how do you get into your writing zone, getting that zone, that flow state?
Oh man, I don't have a flow state. I wish I had one. No routines, nothing like that. I have an idea. I sit down, I map it out, and then I try to. So here's how I look at writing. I look at that. Here's the analogy I use. Is that I look at writing as a magnet, as a magnet stone, right? And what I do is the thoughts of my mind are like a steel beam. And that steel beam is not magnetized because although it has poles in it, they're all spinning in different directions. Writing is like running that piece of magnet over the steel and pointing all the poles in one direction. And when that happens, the steel becomes magnetized. Like you can magnetize a piece of metal that way. And now it has force. It can move things. It's a weapon. It's a tool. That's what writing is for me. So a lot of times what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to organize what's in here. When I do that, then naturally, that's my routine. It's trying to organize my thinking.
When you're putting together these articles, how cathartic is it? Obviously, if you're pulling so much from these experiences.
You know what's funny, man? Sometimes I'll be working on something and it's just like a form of therapy. Like when I was writing Sober Letters to My Drunken Self, I think I reached out to 3 or 4 people and I had to apologize for my behavior and really take responsibility for it. And I told them, I was like, you know, I'm not expecting you to say, oh, I forgive you or even to respond. But I'm writing this so you know that I'm taking full responsibility for everything. Even though I was under the influence, I still had the issues. I still did these things. I still behaved in that way. And that's really important to me. Because you know, recognizing a problem is really important. Because if you don't do that, you don't even know what's going wrong. But you also have to really own your role in what the problem has done, what awfulness you've put in the world, or what mistakes you made. So that's one part. The other part, you know, I think back to like I'm working on certain parts on my book now, and I just think about, you know, this life that is that is here that I have to pull from, this is, you know, I always have to stress to people that survivor's bias will make somebody think that they need to go through this shit. Nah, man. Like, what usually happens to people like me is they don't make it for one reason or another. And I was not that dude. Thank goodness. I got lucky. I got the right influences. I did the work on myself when I needed to do the work. But you still look back and you look back to even why you're in the first place. And sometimes I get angry. But this is why forgiveness is important. I talk a lot about forgiveness. I can't do anything about what my mom did, even if I wanted to be angry at her and her decisions. Who am I going to be angry about? Who's that going to come out on? It's going to come out on the people around me. She's dead. I can't even call her up and say anything to her. So I got to work through that. And there's no magic to that. I'll rephrase. There's no magic to it, but there's a process. And going through that process has been really helpful. And you just keep doing it because, you know, like sitting here with my kid, a lot of times I'll have a thought and I'm like, I don't understand how my dad could so easily have just left and left and not been a part of his children's life. I like putting him to sleep so I can do work. But I take him with me when I go get coffee. He's 10 months old, man. He can't do anything. And I'm like, I couldn't imagine going, all right, I'm done with my, I'm going to go live over here across state, see my kids once a year for a few hours. So I could get angry at that. Because everything we know, let's forget everything we know now about the importance of the father in the home. To me, sometimes I look back and I go, man, there's just no love there. How could you just do that, period? Like, forget making the decision mentally. You figure out how to make it work. I'd be like, look, I understand two people not staying together if it don't work out, because a volatile home is way worse than one without the father in it. And we know this. Empirically, that's one of the traumatic events. And, you know, your parents separating is not witnessing domestic violence or arguing. That's one of them. Okay, that's the kind of stuff that I think about because I have to deal with it. But it provides great writing, and then in writing, I get to look at it and I get to go, wow, okay. You know, that's what the writing really is for me. It's just a form of therapy in that regard.
This forgiveness you're talking about, this forgiveness is not just to other people, but to yourself as well.
Absolutely. You're the hardest person to forgive. You're the hardest person to forgive because you know, you can intellectually work your way to some type of rationalization of the other person's behavior and understanding. And if you do this correctly, you eventually realize that, like, all they're trying to do is seek peace. It's nothing personal. But then you got to work it on yourself and you feel like you're that same person that did the thing that you got to forgive yourself for. But the reality is you're not. And for any other reason, then you're able to reflect and look at this and actually feel something. Now, if you're just looking back at it and feel nothing, completely different story. But when you go and you legitimately feel bad and you feel remorseful and have regret, then you're able to make the move and go, okay, but you know, I didn't know that, or I wasn't prepared here, and these things happened. And that influenced me this way. And it's okay to look at myself and go, that's not who you were. You might have the same body, but even that body recycles itself completely every 7 years. And as you grow and you learn and your heart, your software gets updated and your hardware eventually replaces itself. At some point, you're not the same person. at all. It's hard because we live, especially in America, we live in a place where that type of thinking is foreign. We're like, we don't like to, for example, give prisoners a second chance. We try to, we rope them in on what's been deemed the electronic plantation, where everything you've ever done, you can't escape it. Same with social media and anything put on the internet. Now, you know, you can't ever, people can't ever move past, they can't move past the past because they want to hold stuff against people for the past, and then their thoughts change. Now, yeah, there is a thing to be said about decency, and then you hear the apology and you go, what to do with? But all of this comes back to why it's hard, difficult to forgive yourself, because you don't get that, you don't feel like you get that benefit of a doubt that you're a different person now, but you are. The mere fact that you're able to look at it and feel bad means you are. Now, if you don't feel bad, that's different.
And your writing helps you with that, this forgiveness.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
What are you writing now? What are you working on right now?
The book Hard Lessons from the Hurt Business. That's the book that got me my deal with Penguin, and or the proposal anyhow. Hopefully I finished the book.
Right.
And it's pretty much about how boxing and helped me with life, but how a lot of my life there are lessons that helped me with boxing as well. And seeing how those two work together.
Looking back on your boxing career, is there something you might have done differently?
Yep. I would have fought as a cruiserweight. No hesitation at that. But I was fighting in a very weird era. We were moving into the realm of the suit, because these guys are behemoths now, man. They are. They look like they were not even. I wrote an article why I quit boxing, you know, with one loss. And one of the points I make is the size. You look at it up until 1990, with the notable exception of Muhammad Ali, who was 6'3", most heavyweight champions were 6'1", at the tallest. I think Jack Dempsey was 6'1". Well, didn't Tyson 5'11"? George Foreman was 6'4", right? But he was beaten by Muhammad Ali, who was a lanky 6'3", right? And then in the late 90s and ever since, it's been, you know, Lennox Lewis 6'6", Vitaly Klitschko 6'7", Deontay Wilder 6'7". Tyson Fury 6'9", and because those guys are so big, everyone of those are the champions. I calculated for that article. I did research and calculated the average height of fighters in the top 50 is 6'4", and that is heavily skewed to the left. Like, most of them are taller than 6'4". There's a few guys who are like 6'1", who you know, pull it down, but most of them are taller than that. And I'm 6'1" and a half. I give myself a half. So, you know, I'm not a big guy. I would have just cut the weight and fought at a lighter weight division. But we'll see. Now, one of the things I plan to do with the book, because I still plan on taking fights. I was supposed to be training to get better, to try and go fight again with some new knowledge and with this idea. But, you know, I realized something with having a kid, man. You don't have all the time you used to have. It's just not there. Like, so it's a far sacrifice, because the book is going to do more for me than the fighting, and I'm still in great shape, and I would never, you know, it's just, we'll see, but the book is going great. It's going great. I'm really clarifying a lot of ideas and things that I hadn't thought about, and piecing this together, and really feeling good about how it's being pieced together.
Oh, that's great. I wish you look on the book. If you could, give one piece of advice to help a person who's trying to, I guess is considering sobriety, you know, improve their performance and overall well-being, what would it be?
Man, you know, figure out what's important to you and pursue it relentlessly. And what you'll find is that you really don't have time for drinking. But outside of that, I'd say, you know, one of the hardest things to just accept that you're going to have to change your environment. You might lose friends. Once you accept that, it's easy. That's the big fear. I talk to a lot of people, and either recovery or about to try recovery. And it always comes back to, I don't know how I'm going to socialize now. Or I have no idea how I'll socialize and fit in the future. Which is an incredible trick that the alcohol companies have played on us.
And so it's really the environment. Again, it goes back to always the environment. Just showing up into that gym sets the stage for everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You get there and you do it. And you know, really a lot of it is, you know, you just kind of put one foot in front of the other. And as long as you're on the right path, you'll get to the right destination eventually. The problem is when you're in the wrong path.
Yeah, you know, if you have it, you have that goal or that mission, and you're really focused in pursuing that, then that solves a lot of problems, even a lot of you know, health problems you can have if you have that goal. Then everything else becomes an obstacle in the way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Well, Ed, I can talk to you forever. You're so fascinating. I appreciate it. This is a good place to wrap up. So thank you for being on the show. Is anyone wants to reach out to contact you? How would you recommend them?
Man, just follow me anywhere where Ed Lattimore exists. I'm not the same thing on almost every platform. Ed Lattimore on LinkedIn, Ed Lattimore on Twitter, Ed Lattimore on Instagram, Ed Lattimore One on IG. You know, just type in edlattimore.com is my website. So, yeah, find me, reach out, say hello.
Excellent. All right, thanks, Ed, for taking the time to be on the show.
Hey, thank you, man. You have a good one.
Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. Any information about this week's guest can be found in the show notes, along with other resources for upgrading your own performance and enhancing your well-being. Lastly, if you want to join the Stamina Lab community, head on over to staminalab.io. Until next time, be well.